Yeah, very good evening. Glad to see all of you all here this evening. For today and tomorrow evening, we are going to look through the book of Ecclesiastes. Of course, not the whole book. It is 12 chapters long and we only have two evenings. But we'll try to cover, at least for tonight, chapter 1 and 2, or as much as we can. And then tomorrow evening, we will come to the conclusion of the book, which is in chapter 12. Now, before we look into chapter 1 and 2 itself, just a brief introduction about the book of Ecclesiastes itself. It's a very wonderful book. It's it's a book that I enjoy a lot. The notes that you have before you, I didn't just produce it over the past few days, but actually it's a study that I've done previously, quite a number of years ago. And I had the opportunity then to teach it at two other occasions at a uni fellowship in Perth and then also in Singapore. And each time as I came back to this book and to study it afresh, many more interesting things that the Lord was able to bring to light that I was able to glean from this book. And really, it is a book of wisdom. It is part of what we call the wisdom scriptures in the Bible, in the Old Testament, and all these books of poetry. Three of them written by Solomon, the man who is known as one of the wisest men or the wisest man to have ever lived. He wrote the book of Proverbs, he wrote the Song of Solomon, and he also wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. But really, I mean, if you read through these books, perhaps you can say the book of Ecclesiastes is really the summation of all the wisdom that he amassed through his life. I mean, he was a very wise man. The Bible says that. And this wisdom was granted to him from the Lord. But what comes to us in the book of Ecclesiastes is also his wisdom coupled with his experience in life. He probably wrote the book of Proverbs early on in his life before he turned away from the Lord. Likewise for the book of Song of Solomon. But we know about his life experience. He turned away from the Lord. He went into the world and he lived a life of excess, a life of sin, surrounding himself with all the pleasures and the luxuries of this life with 1,000 women. And his heart turned far away from the Lord. But through all these experiences and through all these endeavors, he learned, painful though it may be, painful lessons about life. But then at the tail end of his life, he came back to the Lord and he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, sharing with us, basically to say, please don't make the same mistakes that I made. Please don't go down these same paths and go through all these pains and sufferings and difficulties, groping around and searching for the meaning of life. And all this while it was right before him, simply to fear God and keep his commandments, and that is the whole duty of men. That is really the thesis of our entire study this evening and next as well. As we ask this question, now what is the meaning of life? It's a rather fundamental question, isn't it? I mean, it's something that philosophers have been discussing, arguing about all throughout the years, throughout the ages even. Different philosophers, different schools of thoughts have come out. Plato, Aristotle, Epicureans, the Stoics, and these different way of thinkings. And they will come to different conclusions. They say, oh, the meaning of life is the pursuit of knowledge. Oh, the meaning of life is the pursuit of happiness, of luxury, of fun. The meaning of life is to find the divine within. The meaning of life is this and of that. And, you know, through our lives, as we go through our varied experiences, as we have different sorts of upbringing coming up in different cultures, in different social circles, we all sort of come to our own conclusion of the meaning of life as well. We all formulate our opinion, whether consciously or subconsciously, right? That within us, there is a sort of system that we adhere to. That gives us the reason or the motivation as to why we do anything at all. Because we all have to answer this question, what am I here for? What am I living for? What is the purpose of this life? And of course, in our current, what we call a postmodern era, everyone has so-called a right to their own opinion, right? Well, you think what you think, and I think what you think, I think, and we are all right, right? Nobody, who's to say you are wrong or I am right? Who's to say that there is one exact precise meaning of life? No. Right? Everyone is entitled to his own opinion. Everyone lives the way that he wants to live, and we don't judge. Right? I mean, that's the prevailing sort of mindset in our present day and age. Everyone has a right to their own opinion. Everyone is right. Nobody's wrong. And so you can live your wanton lifestyle, your hedonistic lifestyle, a life of pleasure, excess. Well, that's fine, right? As long as you're happy, as long as you find fulfillment, well, go ahead. You can go to church, you can go to your mosque, you can read your scriptures, you can do whatever you want. Everyone, it's all right. Nobody's going to judge. Well, at least that's how the world views this answer, this question in this day and age. What's the meaning of life? Well, everyone is entitled to his own opinion. But is that true? Is that really what we are here for? Is that really why God has created us? So that all of us can just chart our own course in life, do what we want, at the end of this life say, well, I have no regrets, I'm leaving. What is really the purpose of why we are here? The book of Ecclesiastes will attempt to answer this question, but in a rather unique fashion. Okay? It does not come, like some other books in the Bible perhaps, as a very direct, exhorting sort of way, right? Where it just tells you this is it. It is more, as you can say, perhaps a sort of biographical account of Solomon's experiences, where he recounts, firstly, personally, his own experiences. Then after that, he's going to look at various observations that he has had, right? From chapter 3 onwards, he talks about different observations that he has throughout his whole life. And then after that, he also gives certain sort of words of wisdom or advice, before finally coming to a conclusion in chapter 12. And so really, to understand the entire book of Ecclesiastes, and to really get the most out of it, okay, we have to study everything. Of course, time will not permit us to do so, but I'll try to give the relevant salient points. But really, as we go through this book, what we do is we follow the experiences of a man. That's all. We follow the experiences of a man. A man who is not always godly. A man who tried, right, to find different avenues and ways by which he can find meaning in his life. And time again, what he's going to tell us is, that was vanity. That was nothing but a vexation of spirit. He said he tried. He really tried. Okay? And when he did things, he didn't have any half-hearted measures. He really went all the way out into these different experiences. And these are common experiences. The sort of things that, well, you and I would also perhaps, at some point or time in our life, also try to experience. But through it all, he says, no, take it from me. I have experienced it. And I write to tell you that all these things are not the answer. These are not the ways in which God wants us to really have the best out of this life. Okay? And so primarily in chapter 1 and 2, that is what we are here to study, to give us a biographical account, right, of his own life. Okay, it's not a normal chronological sort of biography where it goes through, well, when he was born, when he was young, what he did. But basically he highlights to us certain endeavors that he had throughout his life. Okay, certain things that he tried to experiment with, and he gives us the conclusion. So that's what we can see, all right, from this book of Ecclesiastes. Now, if you go to the notes, there are the first about 7 or 8 pages. This is actually, the bulk of it is just an introduction. Okay, so we're not going to go through it in great detail. We're just going to breeze quickly through it, right, to help us to have a common frame of understanding as we look through this book. Okay, and so if you have the notes, please look there. I hope there are enough. We printed about 40. So if there are not enough, perhaps, can we print some more? Yeah, there's still some more being printed. All right, so, basically, I'll just very quickly run through this book. Okay, so we've gone through the introduction. Now, the name of the book, Ecclesiastes, is actually taken from the Greek version, sorry, the Greek name of the book in the Greek translation, and that's Ecclesiastes. But it is actually from the Hebrew word, which is Koheleth, right? The word Koheleth really means preacher. But not just preacher in the sense of a person to preach, but the root meaning of this word is a person who gathers people together, to assemble. Okay? And that is how he describes himself, right? Right in chapter 1, verse 1, he says, the words of the preacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem, Vanity of Vanity, said the preacher. And so that's how he describes himself. Although he's king, but his angle in which he approaches this book is that of a preacher. He says, the reason why I wrote this book is so that I gather all people together and I want to share my experience. I want to teach. I want to bring to light some of these nuggets of wisdom that the Lord has brought to me, and I'd like to share it to you. Okay? So that is the meaning of the word Koheleth, and it is translated in the Greek version of the Old Testament as Ecclesiastes, and so that's where we get the English name of the book from. Okay, and so that is as much as we can say about the name of the book. Well, the author is undoubtedly Solomon, as I've been mentioning a number of times. Okay, again, you see that clearly in verse 1. The words of the preacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, there was only one legitimate king that was Solomon's son. Now, of course, there were other usurpers, right? Like Absalom, he tried to install himself as a king, but he was not a true king of Jerusalem, of Israel. Solomon was the only one, okay? And so very clearly, I mean, in the very first verse, we have a clear indication of who wrote this book. Now, there are many, of course, liberal scholars that try to put doubt into the words of God. They say, oh, maybe it's not Solomon. Or say, oh, you know, look at the language Solomon uses. Oh, look at the perspective he comes from. Maybe it's not Solomon. Maybe it's some other author that wrote this and tried to attribute it to Solomon, things like that. But we dismiss all these arguments, okay? Because we take God's word as it is. Chapter 1, verse 1 says, it is the words of the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And we take it as it is. All right, so it's Solomon. And you see, when we understand it to be Solomon, it helps us to understand the historical context of this book much, much better. Because in the Bible, we are given a lot of information, right, about who Solomon is, who Solomon was, right? The son of David, described as one of the wisest or the wisest men to have ever lived. He inherited the throne from his father David. And we can read, well, all these accounts of his life in both the books of 1 Kings and also 1 and 2 Chronicles. Right? He was very, very rich. He was renowned throughout the region for his wisdom. He wrote lots of proverbs. He wrote lots of songs. Right? And he also engaged in a lot of building projects. He built the temple of God. He built his own house. He also built other temples, right, for his idolatrous wives. You can read all of this throughout these passages. And that's very much in line with what we see in chapter 2 as well. Okay? Now, I have explained this earlier. This is likely to have been written at the end of his life. Okay? After he experienced all the experienced in his lifetime, he started out well. He was humble. The Lord asked him, what do you want? And he said, well, I don't ask for riches or, you know, power and things like that. I just need to know how to rule the kingdom. That's what he told the Lord. He says, I'm inexperienced. I'm young. I don't know how to rule well. And so the Lord was pleased with his request. The Lord was pleased with what he said and said, well, as much as you didn't ask for wealth and riches and things like that, I will give it to you along with wisdom. All right. And so that's what Solomon was given. And we see proofs of all this wisdom early on in his reign in some of the decisions that he made. And also later on when the Queen of Sheba would travel all the way just to hear his wisdom. And that was how great he really was, right? And when they went there, they said, well, you know, your reputation does not live up to how great you really are. And truly, they looked at him and said, you are truly a very wise man. But sadly, this praise of his wisdom mentioned nothing about his devotion to the Lord. And we see that by then he had already started to turn away from the Lord. Yes, he was wildly successful in the eyes of the world. Right, his kingdom was doing well. He managed it properly. Right, he didn't have much conflict or war. He was well versed in diplomacy. Okay, And so he had many trade agreements, many treaties, alliances with many of the surrounding nations, and they gave him tribute. They paid him money, right? Because they recognized the greatness of his kingdom. But sadly, there was little said about how godly he was, how much he loved the Lord, how much he had taught the people to love the Lord. None of these things. They simply said, well, your people are well organized, your kingdom is well run, your palace is in good order. That's all. And when you realize that Solomon, although he was successful in the eyes of the world, in the eyes of the Lord, he probably failed. And that's what we see as we come to 1 Kings chapter 11. By then, he had turned away from the Lord. He had 700 wives, 300 concubines. And the Lord said that was really the root of his problem. He allowed these things to turn his heart away from the Lord. Because he loved these women, he also loved their idolatrous gods. They were not believers. And the Lord judged him. The Lord said, well, you have turned away from me, and I will take the kingdom away from your son. So that's what happened to him. Because after his reign, the kingdom split. It was no longer just the kingdom of Israel. It had now divided into the northern and the southern kingdom. Why? Because of Solomon's life, because of how he turned away from the Lord. So that's what we can say about his life, right? He started out well, but somewhere along the line, his pride, his love for other women, and various sins caused him to backslide. And backslide in quite a terrible way. But we thank God that it didn't end there, because at the close of his life, he turned back to the Lord. How do we know that? Well, from the book of Ecclesiastes. Okay? By now, he's an old man. He has lived his life. He had gone through all these experiences. But now he had learned. He had realized that now, that life that he used to live, as much as it is perhaps enviable in the eyes of many, it was a life of vanity. It was a life of sin. It was a life which God did not approve of. And therefore, he wrote to us to tell us, don't make the same mistakes that I have made. Okay? And as we look at the purpose in page 4, okay, that's what we see of why he wrote this book. Because many critics of this book will say, you know, maybe these are just the writings of the deranged man, a person who was depressed, right? A person who was disillusioned with life, jaded. And sometimes maybe you say that, if you look through, yeah, it seems to be, because he keeps going on, oh, this is vanity, that is also vanity, vexation of spirit. He's like this old, jaded, bitter man, right? Where he just critiques everything, nothing is worth doing, everything is bad, everything is terrible. It seems that way, at face value perhaps, but that's not why the book was written, right? It was not just the ramblings of a person who is angry with life and upset with God, and he just wants to get all these things off his chest, right? That's not why the book of Ecclesiastes was written. We can look at the words of Albert Barnes, one of the old commentators. He says, this author was evidently a man of profound faith in God, of large and varied personal experience, of acute observation of men and things, and of deep sensibility. Probably he was first moved to write by a mind painfully full of the disappointing nature of all things viewed apart from God. Now that's a key thing. Apart from God. Why he says all these things are vanity, vexation of spirit? Because, well, God is not in the picture. God is not involved. And as long as that is, there is no meaning in the life that you live. And so he says, well, it was disappointing, this life that is apart from God. And then by a deep sympathy with fellow men touched by the same natural feelings as himself and suffering like him through each in their several ways. Okay, and so he realizes that many out there in the world, they are just like him. Also disillusioned with life, or perhaps questioning, what's the point? As I'm doing all these things, as I'm working so hard, is there really a point to all these things? And so he writes to us to tell us, yes, but we have to do it the right way. We have to bring God into the picture in order for us to realize what life is all about. Because as long as we live life without God, yes, we're going to end up like him. Vanity, vexation of spirit. And so he says he was deeply sympathetic of men like him. And then thirdly, by the evident desire to lead other men, and especially young men, out of the temptations which he had felt, and out of the perplexities which once entangled and staggered him. Okay? And so that's again why he wrote, because he understands human nature. He understands the weakness of humanity, of how we are so easily led to fall into temptation. We have this great propensity to sin. And as he realizes that about men, he realizes that I must also share my words of wisdom. I must help them. Because all of us are the same, isn't it? We are all also often misled by all the temptations that surround us. And we need these sort of reminders. We need these words to wake us up, remind us that now this life that you are living is meaningless if God is not in the picture. Okay? So he'll bring up a number of different themes and topics throughout his exhortations, right? And we're going to look at some of these words, right? Firstly, words that he repeats a number of times. The first one I've been mentioning quite a few times already, and that is vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Out of the 72 times that it occurs throughout the whole Bible, more than half of it is in the book of Ecclesiastes. Okay? And so it's really a book of vanity. And that's actually the topic for tonight, right? Vanity of vanities. Now what is this all about? Okay? The word vanity literally means air, a vapor of breath. Right? It signifies this meaning of something that is very vain, empty, temporal. Right? Like a breath of air. You breathe it out, it's there, it's gone. You can't quite grasp it. It has no form of, or it's just nothing. Okay? Like air, like vapor, like a breath. And so he says now, many of these things which he did, his conclusion was that it's empty. It doesn't mean anything. It brought no fulfillment or satisfaction or meaning to his life. Okay? So we're going to see him repeat this phrase again and again and again. As he brings up his different experiences, as he brought up his different observations, right, as he went out, right, throughout his kingdom, he made many observations, he saw many things, and his conclusion at the end of every one of them was, that is empty. That's meaningless. That's useless. That's pointless. Okay, so he's going to repeat this phrase over and over again. That's how he begins his book, and that is how he will end this book as well, reminding us that many things in this life, if it is not done for God or with God in the picture, it's meaningless. It's useless. Okay? Next phrase, and many other things you can just read for yourself, vexation of spirit. Okay? Vexation of spirit, this word vex has this idea to anger or agitate something. Right? You feel very vexed, you feel very worked up. That's the meaning of this phrase, vexation of spirit. Okay? If you look at the Hebrew word, it actually presents an even more vivid image. It has this idea of feeding or devouring. And he says, it's like feeding upon my soul, a vexation upon my soul. It's like my soul is being eaten up as I witness and experience all these things. Great anguish, great pain. So it's perhaps even stronger than vanity of vanities. Vanity just means meaningless, worthless. Vexation is something, it goes one step further. It says, brings grief to the soul and the heart of a true believer. Right? Of a person who really ought to be giving his life over to the Lord, but he doesn't, and he eats at him. And that was the experience of Lot. Remember Lot, Abraham's nephew, the person who found his way to Sodom and Gomorrah and surrounded himself with the filth and the sin of this world? Although he did not have the moral courage to bring himself out of that sinful, wicked city, the Bible says that he was just, meaning justified. He was a believer. But daily, as he was in the city, surrounded with the filthy conversation of the wicked, he was vexed in his soul. And that's what Solomon experienced as well. Right? But you know, really later on in his life. After he experienced all these things, and then he says, well, these are really just very vexing. It brings him nothing but grief and anguish. Okay? Now, our next word we want to look at is under the sun. And that's the first, that's a word you see in verse 3. He asks this question, what profit or what use hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? where is the sun? I mean, generally, the sun is up there in the sky. Okay? And so when he uses this phrase, it's a phrase that's unique to him, unique to the book of Ecclesiastes. And so it's probably a term that he coined himself. Okay? And so when we regard the sun, and we think of the sun, well, it's up there, and it is often associated with the abode of God, where heaven is, basically. Okay? And so when he talks about under the sun, what is under the sun? Well, basically everything that is here on this earth, right? Because that is the thing that dominates what is above, the thing that dominates the sky is the sun. Okay? And so everything that is happening here on this earth, it is referred to as, well, activities under the sun. But in this context, it also means then things that are apart from God. That means everything that is focused on earth, on these earthly things, the temporal nature of this earth, right? Where it is just done on this earth and that's it. There's no further, greater, or eternal value or meaning to these works. So that's what he means here, right? It is used synonymously with under heaven. So under the sun, under heaven. Because heaven, again, is, well, what's up there. And so he says, well, things that are above this earth or above the sun are those that are directed to heaven, though those are of eternal value because God is in the picture. But things that are done under the sun is basically referring to things that, well, God is not involved in. Okay? And so that's how he's going to use it. He uses it quite a number of times as well. Very first, from the very beginning, verse 3. He asks this very pertinent, very probing, we can say even piercing question, isn't it? What profit? What's the use if you live your life under the sun? And you work hard and you have all your labor. At the end of your life, as you look back at everything that you have accomplished, and you realize that God was not there at all. And so he asks, well, what's the point? What's the point? What fulfillment, what meaning, what satisfaction can you really have of all these things? If it is done, where God is not in the picture. Okay, so that's a very meaningful phrase that he uses. Vanity of vanities, vexation of spirit, and then the phrase, under the sun. Another phrase that he says, eat, drink, and be merry. It is actually a thought that is repeated again and again throughout this book, a total of 5 times. And it comes as a sort of like a mini conclusion to some of the points that he made. Okay, we'll see that at the end of chapter 2. And so we're just going to skip this section, and we're going to come back to that idea when we come to the end of chapter 2. Okay. And then there are a few other thoughts of the use of the word Elohim and the word for man, which is Adam. Okay, that is another observation that we have, is that throughout this entire book, he never uses the word Jehovah, right? God's covenantal name. He uses God's generic word for God, and that is Elohim. Okay, that's the Hebrew word for God. And then also, he only uses the word Adam, which is the word for man. And the emphasis is on the man who was made from the dust of the earth. Okay? And that is, well, basically in the name of the first man of Adam. But then what's the significance of these uses of the word here? Basically, when he uses God and not Jehovah, the emphasis here is on the power, the sovereignty, perhaps the creative nature of God, the fact that it is God who created. When God uses his name, Jehovah, that invokes rather the covenantal relationship that he has with his people. But when, you know, Solomon wrote this book, his emphasis was more on the regard and respect for God as the creator. Remember, that's how he begins chapter 12. Remember now thy creator in the days of thy youth. Okay? And so that is the aspect or the element of God that he wants to bring forth, and likewise the aspect of men. That we are nothing compared to God. We are but the dust of the earth. We are created from the dust. God breathed life into us, and therefore we must have a relationship with our Creator. Okay? So that's perhaps one thing that we can see being brought out through the use of these words in the book of Ecclesiastes. Okay? Throughout this book, he'll touch on a number of very common themes in life, riches, labor, wisdom, death. I mean, these are very, very common issues of life that we grapple with, right? Money. Everyone has to deal with money in their lives. Everyone has to labor. Everyone has to work in their lives. Everyone needs wisdom. and everyone will have a different measure of wisdom. But ultimately, it is appointed unto man once to die. We will all have to face death. And so as he meanders through these different themes, and he's going to bring them up again and again and again. Okay? He's going to help us to have the right perspective towards all these different things. What is riches all about, and how are we to rightly perceive and use it? What is labor all about? What is wisdom? And what is true wisdom? What is the wisdom that we must seek after? And how must we rightly understand death? Okay, so these are certain themes that we're going to see being brought up throughout the entire book of Ecclesiastes. Okay, not just in chapter 1 and 2 and 12, but also the entire book. Now, we come then to chapter 1 and chapter 2. And as I said earlier, chapter 1 and 2 gives us really his personal biography, right? Where he shares with us all his experiences in life. He makes certain observations, but really the gist of it all is to tell us and highlight to us that if you want to really find the meaning of life, it is not found in all these areas. But yet these things that he did are very common. It's something that all of us can identify with. Maybe different people have different objectives and goals in life, but by and large, it falls within one of these major categories that he brings to us. That's why I say this is a very applicable book, right? Good for all of us to study. But before he gets to that, he gives us a very interesting introduction, right? From verse 4 to verse 11. What does he tell us here? So he says, one generation passeth, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. So right from the very onset, he juxtaposes life with nature, right? Human life, side by side. He says, well, basically, you and me, we are just a generation, isn't it? Okay, a generation, how long does it last? 20, 40, 60, 80 years at most? And then one life is gone, and another generation comes and takes its place. And so throughout the course of human history, thousands and thousands of generations have passed, isn't it? And in it, billions and billions of people have lived and existed on this earth. And you compare that or contrast that to the earth, to this earth, our earth, our planet. It's been here from the very beginning. God created the heavens and the earth. And up to this point of time, when Solomon is writing, a few thousand years down the road, it was still there. It was as it is. Nothing had changed. And then now, as we read this book, right, there's another few thousand years have passed from the time that Solomon wrote it, in about 940 BC or so, until now, it's about 3,000 years have passed. But the things that he says continue to hold true, isn't it? Thousands of generations have passed in the meantime, but the earth continues to abide forever. It is here, as long as God wants it to be here, before he finally comes and destroys this earth and recreates it in the new heaven and new earth. But until then, this earth will continue. And so he looks out at nature and he observes these various cycles of life in nature. He says the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to his place where he arose. I mean, basically, that's the rising and the setting of the sun, right? And so it rises, it goes, and then it moves, okay? And of course, you say, hey, that's scientifically wrong, right? It's about the evolving of the earth, it's not the moving of the sun. Now, of course, this is from the perspective of someone on the earth, and that's what it looks like, isn't it? Right? He was not writing a science book to be, in a sort of way, he's not teaching us, well, the exact movements of the earth and the sun. It's just basically an observation. He says, well, that's what happens, isn't it? It rises, it sets, and you know that this is perhaps the most reliable thing in this planet, that it will definitely come up the next day, right? It's something that will definitely happen, as sure as the sun will rise in the east, right? That is a certainty. And so he says, well, that's life. Every single day the same. It keeps on happening. And what else? He talks about the winds. It goes to the south, the north, it whirls about continually, and the wind returneth again according to its circuits. And it's interesting that he makes this observation that there is a certain pattern to the weather. the circuits, right? Of course, he didn't know about the cold, the low pressure, high pressure, and how the winds will collide and create clouds and all these weather patterns. I'm sure he didn't know exactly, right, what our weather people know today. But nonetheless, he had this observation that in the years of his existence and the years to come and the years that have passed, that's how it's always been, right? The winds keep on going, creating all the different seasons. The water cycle in verse 7, the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. That's true, isn't it? It looks like the water keeps on going to the sea, but the sea never full. Why? Because there's evaporation, it forms the clouds, it comes down as rain, and the cycle again keeps on repeating. And back to the original idea, one generation passed, the other generation comes. And throughout all these billions of people that have been living on this earth, have they done anything to change it? Yeah, maybe a little bit, right? They say, oh, the sea levels are rising. How? By a few centimeters. Yes, maybe that is quite a major difference, true, but on the grand scheme of things, the earth abides forever. Everything just happens the way they are and the way they were. And so in a sense, he's talking about the repetitiveness of these cycles, the constancy, but yet he also speaks of a lot of movement, right? Well, all these things are swirling about. Everything is moving. Everything is, you know, keep on in their motions. And in contrast to that, there is man. Now that's really his point. He wants to bring about this contrast where man, in his pride, thinks that he is so great, right? I am the ruler of this world. I have dominion over all these things. Oh, look at me in my smartness, in my intelligence, my intellect. Oh, we have created, invented, devised so many different clever tools and machineries. And man thinks that he is something great. Man thinks that, you know, he is the pinnacle of this earth. But Solomon really puts us in our place as he writes these words. He says the generations will keep on going, but it will just have little effect on this earth that will continue on in a cycle. I mean, man, for all his skill and ability, the rivers keep on flowing. Yeah, you have dammed certain rivers, you have blocked certain rivers. But by and large, everything just continues the way it is. Can you, in all your ability, change weather? You cannot. The forces of nature are great. Right, and a storm, a tornado comes, a hurricane comes, you can do nothing but to shut your windows and try to hang on tight. That's about it, isn't it? Can you change the movement of the sun? Nothing. Man cannot do anything in light of all these things. Yes, all things are full of labor, but man cannot utter it. Man cannot fully explain it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, the ear filled with hearing. You can never know and comprehend, much less to change any of these things which God has set in place. Basically, that's what he's trying to highlight to us, that man is nothing. Man is insignificant. Man, contrasted to the greatness of the nature of God, we are nothing but dust. And that's what he wants us to realize from the very beginning, that this is really, I mean, life is, you can say, insignificant in the grand scheme of things. We think much of ourselves, and we think that, well, that, you know, our life is so important. True, we are not here to say that, well, life is cheap or life is just to be casually thrown away. But life, in contrast to God, in contrast to God's creation, in contrast to the forces and the power of nature, we are really nothing at all. Okay, and so that's what he tells us: the thing which have been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. He says, basically, there's nothing new under the sun, right? You look at history, you look at the future, you look at the present. Well, it's all the same. Yes, man, in each succeeding generation, it seems to be a little bit more, with a bit more technological advances. Yes, we create, seemingly, new things. But at the end of the day, there is nothing truly new. I mean, these are all but an extension of God's creation, right? Because we are just coming to scratch the surface of what this world and what this universe is really all about. And as much as man prides himself in all these newfound knowledge, I mean, basically, we are just doing something which God just did with His Word in 6 days, isn't it? He says, wow, man put someone on the moon. Oh, we put a little probe on Mars. Wow. God says, no big deal. I made Mars. I made the moon. That has been spinning there for the past thousands of years, and only now you finally get to it. In a sense, that's what God will say, isn't it? When man stands up and pats himself on the back and thumps his chest and says, well, look at me, I'm so great. No, you are not great. You are nothing. Okay, and that's what he's trying to tell us. That's what Solomon is trying to say here. Because at one point of time in his life, he thought he was great. And then now he has come to realize that nothing, right? Everything, there's nothing new. Is there anything, verse 10, whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It have been already of old time, which was before us. And that is true. Even till today, with all our technological advances, do you realize that we are doing nothing more than trying to mimic nature? That's it. That's about it, isn't it? We say, wow, look at this building that we have made. Have you not seen the works of creation in nature? Have you not seen the mountains? Have you not seen the grand formations of the earth? And we think that this little two-story, or maybe 10-story, or 100-story building is grand. Well, it's nothing compared to the greatest mountains, right? And what is man really all about? We say, whoa, you look, we created computers. So smart, so intelligent. But all that man has done, you still cannot create life. Which to some is the greatest endeavor of computers, they say. Right? The moment that we can create artificial intelligence, the moment we can deceive someone to think that you're actually talking to a living being. Oh, that is when we have arrived. That's the next stage of our, you know, computer advancements or evolution of technology. But that brings us back to square one, isn't it? We are simply trying to do what God did at the very beginning. So there is nothing new. Nothing at all. And so he remarks in verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things which are to come with those that shall come after. Basically, he's saying, each generation will come and pass away, and that's it. No legacy. Yes, maybe a footnote in history. That's about it, isn't it? Of what one generation to another would do. Yeah, in our history, there have been great people that we remember. But again, how much remembrance is there really about these people? Nothing, because they will leave this earth and they are gone. Okay? Yes, we will have books written about them. We have historical records of them. But how much is that really compared to a whole life of the years and the days and the minutes and the hours of his life? It is nothing. And so that's how life will be. And that places us in the right frame of understanding as we try to seek and understand the meaning of life. Where the first point that he wants to bring across to us is that, well, this life is really rather insignificant. Okay? And so that really deals with our pride, isn't it? It deals with our self delusions that perhaps some of us may have. What is the meaning of life? Some people say it is to have an impact, is to make a difference, right? Is to leave a legacy behind. Well, what Solomon's trying to tell us here, that no, that's not going to happen. Because no matter how great you are, there is no remembrance. Yeah, just a little bit, but what's the point, right? What's the end of such a purpose? Is to no end. Because the thousands and thousands of generations, the billions of billions of people that have ever lived in this earth, they've all gone through the same thing. So what else? From verse 12 to verse 18, he then talks about another endeavor, or rather, the first endeavor that he had, and that is the striving of earthly knowledge and wisdom. And when we talk about wisdom here, we are not talking about the godly wisdom that he speaks of in the book of Proverbs, right, where he talks about how to fear God, right, and that is the beginning of all wisdom. It's not that sort of godly wisdom. Okay, we have to understand the distinction here, especially in the book of Ecclesiastes. I mean, it's the same word that he uses, but based on the context, right? Where he decries wisdom here. He says it's not no good, right? It is vanity. So we understand that this is really talking simply about intellect. Okay? How clever a person is. Okay, and that is related to knowledge, related to understanding, right? Related to the intellectual pursuits of man. So he says that's how he began. He says, I was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And, you know, as I regarded my kingdom and as I considered the intellect that was within me, he says, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. He says, that's how he began. As a very clever man, that was something which perhaps he thought would bring him fulfillment, academic pursuits. And generally, this is sort of the domain of people who are intellectual. Okay, people who pride themselves in their knowledge and understanding. And so they have this certain thirst for knowledge, this curiosity. And a lot of people, I mean, they give over their lives into the pursuit of these things. The scientists, the researchers, the people who are creating or trying to understand things. I mean, that's basically what a scientist does, isn't it? That's what a PhD is. You get deeper and deeper and deeper into one specific realm of knowledge, right? And so at the end of all your studies, maybe you've learned something new, in a sense, but something perhaps people didn't know before about this particular field. But to some people, I mean, this is it. This is life. This is what they were made for, and this is what they are here to seek after, right? To know or to discover certain things. And so people will give their lives over, right? To archaeology, to history, paleontology, to all these different fields, right? And they are experts in their fields. And they know so much, okay? About perhaps this particular species of this particular animal that are only known in these particular habitats. And so they live amongst these animals and they know a lot. And they share their knowledge. They write papers, they produce articles, they give lectures, they give talks, they teach. Okay? And that is one area of life. And Solomon, you know, he did not just want to know one thing. Okay? He was not just a particular researcher in one area or one field. He basically says, I want to know everything. I want to know everything. Right? He says, I gave my heart to seek all things that are done under heaven. Now, of course, again, this was a worldly endeavor. It was basically to just understand life as it is. And so he was not just a single PhD holder. He had probably had, I mean, he was smart enough by all today's standards to have multiple PhDs in all these different fields. He was wise in that sense. Right? Where people travel from around the world to hear his wisdom. And I'm sure he was probably a pretty spectacular teacher, an orator. Okay? Because people, when they travel to hear him, they travel just to hear him. Okay? And so he was world renowned as a leading authority in all these different things. And so that's what he accomplished. Thinking that now if I know everything, well, that's satisfaction in life. Well, that's what I'm here for, isn't it? And there were certain philosophers that really, well, had this way of thinking. Right? That the end of man, the meaning of life, is the pursuit of knowledge. And we must keep on learning. Right? And certain people do have this sort of curiosity, and they love to learn. They spend all their time reading. And it's not a bad thing. Right? And then there are people that are very well educated. They can converse or, you know, have a deep, meaningful conversation. It's in a wide array of topics. And to them, they find, I mean, this is their joy, right? This is their pastime. This is, well, what brings them fulfillment in life. But he says, you know, as he did all these things, he realized that it was nothing but a sore travail. What does that mean? It actually talks about the fact that it was a difficult labor. It was even to a point of being painful. It's like an affliction, he says, that God has given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. Meaning to say that now this thirst for knowledge or this curiosity about all the very things around us, he says, it can potentially lead you to a very painful end. Why does he say that? Because he says that I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. He says the more he studied, as the more he understood about the way that things function around him, it didn't bring him joy. It didn't bring him meaning and fulfillment. It brought vanity and vexation of spirit. He realized how empty a pursuit this was. That instead, it actually vexed him. Why? Because he began to see the sin of men. He began to see and understand human nature better. And he began to understand the limitations of knowledge and understanding. Because you can understand a thing very well. You can know about certain things very, very well. But what's the point if you can't fix it? And that's when he realized the limitation of knowledge. Right? Now we study, we study. We study about the calamities of the world. We study about the problems of the world. But we can't fix it. Because many times we are helpless, isn't it? And you read the papers. You read about all the things that are going on. Crisis after crisis. We read about the politics of our land and the sort of conflicts that are happening in parliament, in the government. And we read about the problems in the Middle East and Africa. But what can we do about it? Nothing. Or very little. Very, very little. And so if he thought that now if I know all these things, maybe I can make a difference, well, he was sorely mistaken. Because he says, well, that which is crooked cannot be made straight. That is found wanting cannot be numbered. He says, the things which are lacking, right? That's the meaning of wanting. The things which I realize are wanting cannot be numbered. It's just innumerable. The problems of this world. And so he says, well, education, it only brings you so far, right? Knowledge and understanding, it only satisfies to an extent, but that's it. There is a limit. It brought him sort of to a dead end. Studies, learning. Well, it's not to say, of course, that his learning is useless or all of us should just give up our studies, throw away our books, and just be hermits and ignorant. No. Okay, that's not what the Bible is calling for, and neither is that what Solomon is trying to tell us here. He's basically saying that all these studies, without God in the picture, that is what is fruitless. Right? And a lot of people are locked in such endeavors, thinking that if I give over my life to one of these noble causes, yeah, that is fulfillment, that is meaning. To a point, maybe, you find a certain measure of satisfaction in what you're doing, but that's not the end. That is not what is really fully going to give you fulfillment and meaning in this life. And so he goes on to say, right? That through all these things, he said, I looked at my life, verse 16, I commune with my own heart, saying, no, I am come to great estate. I am so rich, right? I mean, he was the king. He had all the wealth, right, of his kingdom. And I have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. In my heart have great experiences of wisdom and knowledge. Yes, I have all these things. What's the point? I can't do anything. I can change things. I can fix things. And so he thought, well, maybe the real meaning or the real purpose, if I give myself further into this endeavor. And so you see, in verse 13, he says, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done in heaven. So he says, he used his wisdom to search and understand and to try to know all these things. In verse 17, he went one step further. He says, I have seen all these problems of mankind. I have seen the crookedness, I have seen the wantings, the lackings, right, of man. But that's not enough. Maybe is that I don't fully understand it enough. Okay? And so, you know, despite all my wealth and my power, I can't do much. And so therefore, verse 17, he says, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. He says, maybe, you know, I come from a position of, you know, sort of like from a pedestal, and I look down on man, and maybe that's why I don't understand enough. And says, maybe I ought to go further and deeper, and to not just know wisdom, but also madness and folly. Now, what is this? Basically, it's to fully understand not just the, you know, intellectual aspects, perhaps, of life, but also the whole wide range of the human experience, right? About the follies of men, and not just the wisdom, right? And to know, well, how, you know, man and their mystics and what they are doing with their life and all these problems, how it really is. But again, he says, I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. He says that didn't bring him much use as well. It didn't bring him much further into fully having any satisfaction in his life. Because the more he knew, the more he experienced. Okay, so it's not just to know, but also to experience. The more he surrounded himself with all these knowledge and studies, he says it was just emptiness. In a sense, he's saying, well, so what if I know? Right? So what if I can give an explanation of the world's poverty? So what if I can explain the economic downturns, the economic rises of all the things that happen in the world? So what? So what if I can explain and know and understand, right, the movements, right, of the winds of the tectonic plates, and explain why all these calamities happen, of tsunamis, of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions? He says, what's the point? Because the more I know, it just brings more grief. Because God is not in the picture. And all he has done is to perhaps better understand this world around him a little bit better. But at the end of the day, it is still a world of sin. It is still a world lost in its vanity. And he says, it brings me nothing but vexation. And the more that I knew, the more sorrow he had. And that's the stark reality, isn't it? That if we give ourselves over to study, to the pursuit of knowledge, to satisfy our curiosity, thinking that, well, this is what life is about, right? To be a learned man, to be well respected by society, to have a large library. At the end of the day, what's the point? Can you bring your knowledge to the grave? It doesn't bring us anywhere, right? And so that's the first aspect that he went into. But he, as the wisest man to have ever lived, he says, I try to utilize my wisdom, to utilize my great intellect, to study everything about this world. But at the end of it all, it was to no end, right? Nothing good came out of it. So then he started to use the next, perhaps you can say, great gift that he had, and that was his power and his riches. Okay, so the first one was with regards to his wisdom. And he says, well, there was no meaning in that. And then he went to seek after pleasure and accomplishments in this life. And perhaps this is a little bit more relevant to most of us. Well, we say, well, I'm not that sort of scholastic person. I'm not that sort of academically inclined type of person. I just want to have fun in this life, right? That's the meaning of life, isn't it? To enjoy life. Life is short, play hard, right? Happiness is the chief end of man. That is really what I want. And that's what I'm seeking after. And Solomon tells us, well, I did that as well. And so he says, well, next that I did, I said in my heart. So again, you see, all these things are things that he deliberately did. He thought about it, and then he deliberately went into it. Okay? And so these were different endeavors that he had. You know, he was continually perplexed by this question. How can I find fulfillment in this life? And so the first thing he says, I commune in my heart. I determine to seek out wisdom and to know and all these things concerning man. Didn't work. Then he says, well, again, I said into my heart. That means, I had this very deliberate decision. Let's try this instead. Maybe this will work. What was it? He says, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth and enjoy pleasure. Right? That was his next big project. To understand pleasure. To seek out pleasure. to enjoy pleasure. And again, I mean, if you study philosophy, I've not done that, but just very briefly glean the different philosophies of this world, there are a large aspect of it that says knowledge, right, is the meaning of life. And another one actually does say that pleasure is the meaning of life. The pursuit of happiness, that is what we must really seek for. And so Solomon did that. He tried. And right from the very onset, in verse 1, he gives us his conclusion. He says, well, actually, it was vanity. Right? So that's all. He just simply states it as it is. He says, I tried to prove thee with mirth and enjoy pleasure. Right? I looked at the way people were, in their taverns and their inns, and they're laughing their ways away, and it seems so much enjoyment, right? Very enjoyable. Maybe, if I become one of them, and I also surround myself with pleasures of this life, yes, maybe then I can find fulfillment in this life. And he tells us from the very onset, behold, this is also vanity. This is also meaningless. This is also emptiness. This is not going to bring us fulfillment. And I said, of laughter, it is mad. And of mirth, what doeth it? What's the point? You tell a joke. You watch a show. You're entertained for that half an hour. You laugh and you feel good. But after that, what? You need that fix again. You need the next episode. You need the next comedian to come and tell you some more jokes. And then you laugh and you feel good. And then what? You surround yourself with friends and you tell jokes and you have all these comedic moments amongst yourselves and you recount it again and again. But again, to what end? I mean, it's not to say that there's no point doing all these things. But it's to say that this is not the chief end of men. This is not what we must seek after, because some people, to them, that's it. That's life. I work whole week. What I look forward to, the weekend. I go to the pubs, get smashed. Right? Enjoy. Go for a show, a movie. Have some entertainment. Play. Is that really the purpose of life? He says, no. What doeth it? What does it do? What does it contribute to my life? Nothing. And he had a lifetime of all these experiences. And so, from verse 3 onwards, he gives us a description of all his endeavors. Okay? And again, I mean, these are things that we see all around us. And we see people giving themselves over to all these different things. What are they? Firstly, partying with the world. He says, I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under heaven all the days of their life. And so he looked at those partygoers, the people who drink, right? The people who seem to enjoy life. And I am sure that you would know many people of this sort, isn't it? People that seek for these sort of pleasures in their lives, right? And they seem to be having fun. They seem to enjoy life, right? But then we ask, now, is that really what life is all about? I think just 2 Sundays ago, we went for street evangelism, and I was with Uncle Sam, and we met up with one atheist, right? And so we had a pretty interesting, a long conversation with him. But, you know, one of the things that he told me, or what he said, right, is that, I mean, you're doing all these things, you're preaching and you're telling us about the gospel. Yeah, fine by you, okay? But he says, well, you know, I enjoy life, okay? He's telling us that, you know, he says, I go out and drink, I enjoy, and I have all these pleasures, and I'm happy. He says, I'm probably having 20 times, right, as much more fun as you are. But I mean, we just nodded and accepted it. And we told him, yeah, maybe, you know, you think about it, right? Think about what we've been telling him about the gospel, about the need for Christ and of sin and things like that. And he says, you know, maybe, yeah, I may think about it, but maybe you will think about it as well. And when you go home, and you will think about me, who's having 20 times more fun than you are, and maybe you will, you know, think about giving up Christ and maybe you will want this sort of life. Sometimes we may think that way, isn't it? Well, we look around us, and we look at our life, and, well, you know, we sort of generally agree it's not bad, right? Yeah, I come to church, I know Christ, and my sins are forgiven, I'm headed to heaven. But then we look out, And we look at the lives that other people are living, and they seem to be getting along fine without God, isn't it? And it seems to be quite a fun life, right? They're enjoying themselves, and they don't have these limitations of the Bible and of all these rules and things that we should not do and ways that we ought to live. And they don't have to commit so much time to church on a Friday evening, on a Saturday or Sunday morning. And yeah, maybe we begin to be tempted to think, maybe they have it good. Maybe I'd like to experience and have a taste of what their life is like for just a little while. Are we ever tempted sometimes to think that way? I mean, that was basically what he was telling me to do, right? But as much as you talk about God and things like that, hey, why don't you try how my life is like? And that's what Solomon tried to do. He thought, maybe, right? If I give myself over to wine, to drinking, I mean, that was a common pastime in his day and age, and no different from us now, right? Right now, Friday evening, that's when the pubs are full, isn't it? They worked hard a whole week, and now it's time to enjoy. Now, let down your hair, you know, enjoy, have a few drinks, and whatever that comes after it. He says, well, I tried, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom. Okay, so what he means here is that, you know, as he did this, he was careful. He understood about the dangers of alcohol. I mean, he himself wrote Proverbs 20 verse 1, right? Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and if anyone deceived thereby is not wise. Right? He understood that. Okay? He knew the dangers of alcohol. And I mean, he was also given the advice that it's not for kings to drink. Nonetheless, he thought, well, maybe I'd like to experience just a little while, just a little bit. Right? That I may see what was a good for the sons of men, that they should do under the heavens all the days of their life. He says, well, that's their life, right? And that's all they're engaged in doing. Maybe if I try, maybe I'll understand. Maybe I'll grow to enjoy it as well, and maybe I will have meaning in life. Now, of course, it didn't work, right? Because he described it here as really a futile attempt to lay hold on folly. Meaning to say, you know, I tried to grab hold of this foolishness. Of course, it's not going to work, right? You can't fully grasp foolishness. Now, that's how he described it, right? In retrospect, after doing all these things, he says, well, it's really like me trying to grab hold of foolishness, and it is a futile attempt. You can never fully understand. You can never fully be fulfilled in such a life. So that was the first one, partying. Then verse 4 says, I made me great works. I built me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made gardens and orchards. I planted trees in them of all kind of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. He sought to build something constructive, perhaps you may say. Well, I'm not going to while my time away in those pubs and those taverns and those inns. Yes, that's quite useless and futile. And so he says the next thing that he did was to create building projects. Now, he was an engineer, not just that. He was a very well-skilled husbandman, right? He devised irrigation systems for all his plants. You see that? Pools of water to water thereof the woods that bring forth trees. So he planted all sorts of fruit trees, and then he devised a system whereby he had all these pools of water to irrigate these plants. I'm sure it was something that was well ahead of his time. Okay? And so he involved himself in many construction projects. He planted vineyards and gardens and all these things he did. Okay? Very accomplished man. And again, people find fulfillment in all these things, isn't it? Some may, well, I like to be a builder. I like to do something constructive with my hands. Or I like to leave behind a legacy. See, I'm working. I want to see something about the fruits of my labor. A house is what I want. I want to own property. I want to own land. Or maybe some people may say, yeah, I'm tired of this life. It's meaningless, right? Being in a city, working in this dead-end job, 9 to 5, going to an office. Let's go out to the bush, right? I'm going to buy a huge plot of land, thousands of acres. I'm going to do farming. Because, you know, true, honest, hard labor, that's meaning in life. I'm going to sow my seeds. I'm going to raise the crops. I'm going to fill my barns. I'm going to have cattle and sheep, and I'm going to eat off the fruit of the land. That is meaning in life. And some people do that. Again, the answer, no. Right? Yes, I mean, he did all these things. And he was well respected by his peers. I mean, his building projects, right, were really very extensive. And you can read them for yourselves in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles, right, where he spent years, 7 years building the temple for the Lord. And that was, right, truly a magnificent endeavor. Because years and years after, we are still talking about Solomon's temple. It's in one of those lists, right, the seven wonders of the ancient world or something like that, right? Solomon's temple. In all his majesty and splendor, it was truly something magnificent to behold. So much so that years later, after this temple is destroyed, Solomon's temple is destroyed, right? And then the people exiled to Babylon, and they came back and they tried to build another temple in its place. And as they laid the foundations, they began to cry. They began to weep. Why? Because they knew that they are never going to achieve something as magnificent as Solomon was able to do. That was what you read of in the book of Ezra, also in Haggai, right? He says, you look at the present building, is it nothing compared to the glory of Solomon's temple, right? And that was true, at least in terms of physical magnificence. But that was not his greatest, because aside from the temple of God, he also built his own palace, and he took twice as much time to build it, and the dimensions were greater in every aspect, the amount of money spent was also greater, and so it was probably something even more magnificent than the temple that he built. But in all these things that he did, it was really just self-glorifying endeavors. It was just for pride, right? That's what he said. I build me great works. You see that there? It was just for himself. And again, to what end? It may have been a meaningful project to build God a house, but his heart, probably from that early age, from that early time, pride had already begun to set in. Where he looked at all these works and he thought to bring glory to himself. And again, no meaning. It's a fruitless endeavor, right? To try to do all these things apart from God. You see, nothing wrong to work with our hands, nothing wrong to buy a house, nothing wrong to build a house. But if we do it without God in the picture, yes, that is vanity, that is a vexation of spirit. Okay? And that's what he's telling us here. And notice as a side note, look at the number of I's, right, that he has within this passage. I made me great works. I built me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens. I. And it was all for me. I made it for me. That's the root of the problem. When we try to find fulfillment in doing things for ourselves, at the end of it all, we realize, well, that is really nothing at all. Okay? So pride was his problem, and he did all these things, building projects. Next thing that we see in verse 7, huge wealth. And again, I mean, that's very, very common, right? Many people, that is the chief end of man. That is the purpose of my life, to earn money, because money is the answer to all the world's problems, isn't it? Right? If only I had money. If only I was a millionaire or a billionaire, right? Life would be so much easier. Solomon, he had it all. Whatever we can dream or imagine of wanting, he had it. What do you say? I got me servants and maidens. And not just servants. I mean, some people think, well, how nice, isn't it, to have people wait on me hand and foot, to have a butler, a chef, a driver, and have all these people helping me and doing all the things for me. I mean, he went one step further. He says, I had servants born in my house. That means he had families of servants waiting upon him. I mean, after all, he was king. Okay? And so he could have as many servants as he wanted. I also had great possessions of great and small cattle, above all that were in Jerusalem before me. He was the richest person in Jerusalem in terms of his livestock. Okay? Cattle, great and small, as many as he wanted he had. Okay? Daily he could feast on all the different animals. He could eat as much as he wants, whatever he wants, the best cut of the meats, it was all his. I gathered also me silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. And so he became a collector. Because what's the point if it is all just silver and gold? That gets boring after a while, isn't it? And so he was a collector. He bought artworks, different intricate gems or precious stones or different special treasures from around the region. He had it. Okay? Some people do that. Some people are particularly interested in a certain thing, and so they'll be collectors, right? Of clocks, of watches, maybe. Of luxury watches, right? Of art, of sculptures, of different things. And so people collect, thinking that, well, I mean, that brings them a lot of pleasure. That brings them a lot of fun, right? And from time to time, they open their safe, they look at all their watches. Wow. This one was from 1957, this was from 1969. Oh, this one was a special limited edition, only 50 in the world made, and I have two of them. Wow. Some people, I mean, to them, that's it. I mean, this is life, this is the greatest fun that I can have in collecting all these peculiar treasures. For him, it came from kings, from all the different lands, right, that he had a relationship with. They gave him all these tributes. He had entertainments, men singers, women singers, right? People invest thousands of dollars in a hi-fi system. People pay money to go to concerts, the rock concerts. Well, he had them in his house, right? Live performances every day, men singers, women singers. And that was pretty much the entertainment of his time. Now, of course, in our day and age, we are surrounded with a whole huge wide range of different sorts of entertainments. He had the best of his time. The delights of the sons of men, whatever things which delighted men, musical instruments and all of that sorts, he had it all. That was his life, right? All the wealth and everything that money could buy, he had it. And again, thinking that this is what will bring him meaning in life. And so he tells us, verse 9, "And so I was great," and truly, I mean, nobody can dispute that. Right, he was truly very great in every aspect, right? In what he could build, right? In what wealth he had, he was great. And increased all more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. He says, nobody ever lived as I have lived in Jerusalem, ever. And my wisdom remained with me, and I was still very clever, okay? It was not just a foolish throwing himself into pleasure. No, he says, I thought well, and I was intellectual, I was clever. And verse 10, he says, whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. I mean, what a way to live, isn't it? What a way to live. Look at the line again. Whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. And whatever he saw that he liked, he took. It was his. Can you imagine living that way? Either you drive out, you drive to the richest estate in Sydney, I don't know where that is, all the waterfront properties. I like that one. It's mine. Right? Sounds good, isn't it? Well, would you like that life? You open the newspapers, you look at all the advertisements of all the things that, well, that interest you. I mean, different people are interested in different things. My eyes desire it, I keep not from it, I will get it. Right? Go online straight away, order, next day delivery, is that your doorstep? I have it. Whatever you want. I mean, what way to live, isn't it? You think, well, I mean, if that could be my life, I mean, I will be the happiest person ever. You think? I mean, just think about it. Whatever you want. Whatever. That is not just restricted to things. Women. Right? He had how many? 700 wives, 300 concubines. And probably that was the philosophy that brought him to that state, isn't it? Whatever his heart desired, well, that pretty girl looks good. Mine. Next day married, add one more to his harem. That was his life. And we think about, I mean, envious? Are we envious? We try to imagine to have that sort of life. Basically, I mean, it's like a kid that never grew up, isn't it? Because that's how children are. Right? They want it means they want it. And if they don't get it, they're going to cry. I mean, that's the simple logic of a child. Okay? And he just wants it, and it has to be given to him. Imagine, now, of course, we have different restraints, and the framework of society is such that, you know, many things that we would like to have, we can't. And we know them, and so we live within their bounds. But if all these boundaries were suddenly taken away from us, would that bring us joy? Because that's what he did. I withheld not my heart from any joy. Whatever he thinks that his heart desires, and that will bring him happiness and joy and fulfillment, he took it. He had it for himself. And my heart rejoiced in all my labor. This was the portion of all my labor. He says, I deserved it. I worked hard. I was rich. I ensured that my kingdom was running well. And whatever was within my power to get it, I got it. I know many of us do wish for this sort of life, isn't it? Sometimes as we muse about life, as we think, really, what do I really want? What's it that bring me the greatest joy? And sometimes we imagine what a good life it would have been if this can be said of me. And so if you read from verse 3 to verse 11, it sounds good, isn't it? A life envied if anyone could live this life, it is an extremely enviable life. Read about the lives of the celebrities, the rich and famous, that's their life pretty much, isn't it? Whatever they want. They travel around the world, they fly in first class, or maybe more than that, they have their own private jets. Wherever they want to go, whatever they want to eat, they can. Okay? And if you are living in Australia and you think, well, I miss some of those food in Singapore, you can just get your personal butler to take your private plane, fly there, fly back. Is there still hot, fresh, ready for you to eat? Wow, good life, isn't it? Well, up to verse 10, it all sounds very good. But then we look at verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on all the labor that I labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit. Why? Because there was no profit under the sun. I mean, it was enjoyable for a season. It was exciting. It was fun. But after a while, he looked at everything that he had done and everything that he had had. And then he realized it's empty. There's no meaning. I mean, these things can entertain you for a season, for a while, but after a while, you begin to realize, is this really what life is all about? Just in pursuit of the next greatest thing, of the next most exciting thing, of watching show after show, or movie after movie, of whatever entertains you, is that really what life is about? And after a while, I began to get at him. Why? Because he was a believer. Because at the end of the day, he still realized that God is there and God wants a relationship with him, and he did not have it. And that's why he said it was under the sun and there was no profit. There was no meaning. There was nothing to it. It was just, after a while, it's just everything became so routine, right? Is this really life? And he suddenly realized, no, this is not what life is all about. This is not what God made us for. This is not why God gave us this life, to waste it away with the things of this world. Because this is how the world is living. This is what the worldly philosophy will tell you. Life is short. Seize the day. Make sure that you have all the experiences that you ever want to experience before you die. And so you must create that bucket list, right? These are the 10 places in the world that you must go to before you die. These are the 10 foods. These are the top 10 restaurants that you must visit. These are all the things that you must do. Because that is what life is about. Really? Is that really what life is about? Is that what we are here for? And as he thought about it, he began to spiral. Because at this point of time, he was not yet he had not returned to the Lord yet. Okay? So he brings us through this next experience that he had. As he began to think and experience and realize the fruitlessness and the meaningless of this whole life, he then began to go into despair. And that's what you see from verse 12 onwards. Now, as I say here, it says conclusion for a search of meaning, for meaning. But it's really perhaps what you can say a mini conclusion. Because his final conclusion that he really wants us to know comes only in chapter 12. All right? But what he brings us to here is a sort of a mini conclusion, right? That, you know, as he began to realize the vanity of it all, oh, this is what happened to him. The first thing that he began to think about was death. And that was probably the starting point. As he began to age, I mean, it's a sort of natural thing. You begin to realize your own mortality. That you're not going to be here forever. Okay? Your body's starting to slow down. The things that you used to enjoy doesn't perhaps feel as enjoyable anymore. And certain of the limitations and restrictions of age begins to set in. And he looked at what he had done. And then he realized, what's the point? I'm going to die soon. All right, that's what he says from verse 12 onwards. So he brings us back to his first search, right? The one to behold wisdom, manners, and folly, right? That was what we saw in chapter 1. He says, well, I turn myself to behold wisdom, madness, and folly, and what can a man do that cometh after the king? He says, nobody can do it greater than I did. Okay? And it was not a boast, it was a fact. Okay, even that which had already been done. So he said, well, at the end of the day, true, wisdom is good. It excelleth folly, as far as light excelleth darkness. I mean, it's true, isn't it? It's good to be wise. It's good to be clever, right? You look at the life of the fool, they're just bumbling around in the darkness, right? They don't know what they're doing. They don't know where they're headed. They're just living this simple life. He says it's true, right? And the wise man's eyes are on his head. The fool walketh in darkness. Basically, he's saying, well, the wise man, he looks where he's going and he makes informed choices. The fool is just this guy groping in the dark. But yet, as much as wisdom is far better than folly, and a wise man is to be more highly regarded than a fool, yet the same thing is going to happen to both of them. Verse 15, then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me, and to me, well, me the wise man. And so why was I then more wise? He said, what's the point, right? If I was so clever, and I was filled with all this knowledge, I could explain so many different things. And yes, next to me, there is this fool, and to him, well, at the point of time, he says, well, his life is probably worth much less than mine, isn't it? Right? I'm the king, I'm so wise, and he's just a fool. But then, there is the same thing that's going to happen to both of us. We're both going to die. You see that there? He said, well, then what's the point? This is also vanity. For there is no remembrance of the wise more than the fool forever. Seeing that which is that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. How dieth the wise man as the fool? This is the same, isn't it? I'm going to die, he's going to die. And at the end of the day, we're both going to be the same. Just a dead body in the ground. And what's the point of being so wise? Because we're going to die in the exact same way. Right? And what legacy will I leave behind? That was his concern. Right? There'll be no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. And it's true, isn't it? Right? I mean, who's going to remember your IQ after you die? So, oh, this was a clever guy. He had all these, you know, PhDs, or he had these grades and good results, and he won all these competitions. Uh-huh. And then, at the end of the day, he's dead. And this fool, nothing to speak of, and his CV is empty. Right, he did nothing so-called constructive in his life, but both of them died without God. And what's the point? Again, I say, yes, maybe. Your names are recorded here and there, in this book or that book, a footnote in history. But that's the end of it, isn't it? Now, what's the point? And so he says, with that perspective, this was his conclusion. Okay, as I said, this is before he brought God into the picture. These are all things done under the sun. Okay? And therefore, he said in verse 17, I hated life. Can you imagine that? A person whom we just read, right? Whatsoever my heart desired, I kept not from them. He rejoiced in all the works of his labor. He was, at least in the eyes of the world, someone whom everyone wants to be. But yet, I hated life, he said. He was not happy. He had no fulfillment. There was no joy. Why? Because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous to me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. He says, no meaning. I hated this. I mean, can you imagine a person like him coming to such a conclusion to say, I hate life? I mean, that's quite a fall, isn't it? To go from someone who is so active, working, laboring, doing all these different things, and then suddenly like running headlong into a wall, smash, and then he says, well, suddenly life has no more meaning. I hate this life. Why? Because all these things were done under the sun, apart from God, and therefore it was grievous. It brought him nothing but grief. And he realized that this was vanity. It only brought vexation to his spirit. Now, as we consider life in light of death, we suddenly realize that that is true, isn't it? If God is not in the picture, if God is not in the equation at all, if you live apart from God, under the sun, then really it's a very good question to ask. Why are you working for? Why are you doing all these things? What's the end of this life? And he realized that at that point of time to him, it was just death and there was nothing more than that. And so yes, it's meaningless. And so he went one step further to say, I hated my labor, which I had taken under the sun. So he not just hated his life, then he looked at all the works that he had done, he says, I hate that as well. I regret having spent all so much time and effort in doing all these things. Why? Because I'm going to die. And when I die, what happens? I should leave it to the man that shall be after me, and who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet he shall have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. You realize that I'm going to leave all these things behind. All these physical, material wealth, all these pleasures, luxuries, is all going to go. And it's going to go to someone else who didn't work at all for all these things. And who's to know? Is he going to be a wise man? Is he going to rightly manage my estate? Is he going to, you know, be able to continue my legacy? Or is he going to be a fool to squander it all away? I don't know. And for him, it was perhaps after the occasion in 1 Kings chapter 11, when God told him that his kingdom is going to be torn in two, and his son is only going to have a small fraction of it, but the larger part, the bulk of it, is going to go to Jeroboam, right, who was the first king of the northern kingdom. And so God already told these to him, and perhaps that was the point where everything came to a head and he began to think about death, about mortality, and also about the fate of his kingdom. And he says, well, I regret spending all my life building these things up away and apart from God, and now all these things are going to be passed on to someone else who didn't work for it. And he's going to rule in my name. He's going to be king. And what's the point? And so he says, well, because that was all that he had in mind. It was his legacy about the inheritance, that perhaps all this while he thought, I'm going to pass to my son, right? And he says, no, he's going to pass to someone else. Again, what's the point? I mean, some people do that, isn't it? They spend all their life working, right, to pass it on. And especially in our Asian culture, that's quite often how people think, right? That I work hard, never mind, so that my next generation can enjoy. And it's nothing wrong. I mean, it's quite a noble thing to do so. But again, we do not pin our whole hopes on that thing, to think that this is now my purpose, right? To live for my son or for my daughter, for my children. No. Yes, we work hard and we try our best to provide for them, but we do not live for that purpose. We live for God. And that's why Solomon says, well, you know, all this while he lived for that, but then now it's going to be taken away and I hated my labor. And then verse 20 says, he despaired. So it's more than just hated, he despaired. That's why I say it's a spiral, right? He began by contemplating death, began to say that I hated life, I hated my labor, and now I despaired of all the labor. And this word despair is a very strong word, isn't it? The word despair carries the idea of grief without hope, sorrowing without hope, a hopelessness, isn't it? That's what despair is. There's this sense of hopelessness. I think that now life is not worth living anymore. It's not worth, no point laboring, no point doing all these things. That was the state that he found himself in. And he says, well, I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. Again, note, under the sun, right? Apart from God. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and knowledge and equity. And he's talking about himself, right? That I did all these as honest hard work, and I built up this kingdom. And yet to a man that have not labored therein, shall he leave it for his portion? This is vanity and a great evil. Now, he was talking at that point of time, that's how he regarded it, right? Where he was still very zealously guarding his works and his wealth. And he says, well, how could I then leave it to someone else that does not deserve it? Okay? And so, at that point of time, that's how he felt. He felt, this is a vanity. This is a great evil. This is a terrible thing. And I despaired. To what point? To the point where he said, I couldn't even sleep. Right? For what man, for what have a man of all his labor and the vexation of his heart, wherein he had labored under the sun, for all his days are sorrows, and his travail grief, yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night, this is also vanity. This has no meaning. In fact, he lost hope in all meaning at all. He dreaded this life. And all his labor and all his work. He says, I couldn't even sleep at night. He lay awake, tossing and turning, vexing his heart over this issue, over this problem. The thing is not fair. I work so hard, and my son is not going to benefit at all, or maybe just a small fraction of it. And this kingdom is going to go over to someone else. Because he was knocking on the wrong door. He was barking up the wrong tree. He was looking at the wrong places for meaning in life. When he placed all his hopes and dreams on his wealth, on his kingdom, on the things that he had done with the work of his hands. And yes, there is no meaning in all these things. Why? Because God is not in the picture. Because all these works are done for himself, for his own personal gratification. And he says, no, there's no meaning in all of these things. In the last few verses, I think time has run out, and so I'm just going to very briefly mention it. We'll come to that tomorrow evening, right? We'll start with this. But I just want to say, in the last few verses, the mini-conclusion, right? The sub-conclusion he comes is contentment. Okay, that's the main message here, contentment. But that's not the main thing, because the main thing comes in chapter 12 when he tells us that we must remember God, okay? That everything else in life will be a fruitless and meaningless endeavor if God is not in the picture. But at this point of time, to simply address the concerns about his hatred for life and about his despair and hatred for his labor, he says, well, the right understanding that we must have at this point of time is simply contentment. Okay? And as I said, this is not the main conclusion, but this is something that we have to take note of as well. That as we look at our life, we work, true, we work. All of us labor, right? And so he began with a question, isn't it? What profit have a man of all his labor that he takes under the sun? Well, what must we do? We bring God into the picture and recognize that, yes, it is not wrong to labor. It is not wrong to work hard. It's not wrong to have money. It's not even wrong to enjoy, right? He talks about it, to drink and make his soul good in all his labor. But recognize and realize that these all come from the hand of God. And so for the first time in the first two chapters, God is brought into the picture. And that's when he finally begins to see the light. That's when finally it begins to take on a positive note. That all this time it was done with God out of it. But now we bring God in. Now we realize that now I must have God in order for me even to be happy, in order for me even to rightly understand and enjoy the pleasures that God gives us. God has to be there. Because as long as God is not in the picture, nothing but vanity, vexation, hatred, despair. But now he says, no, there is something good that a man can do, to eat, drink, and be merry. How? Only when God is there. We'll talk more about this as we come tomorrow evening, and we're going to consider, well, what then is the chief end of man? What then is the right thing that we must do? And that's when we bring God into the picture. All right, let's turn to the Lord in prayer. Our gracious, loving Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for guiding us through these two chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes. Truly, we understand that many areas, many things that we do it apart from Thee, we do it under the sun. A lot of times we pursue after the things of this world, and we know that this is not what we are here for. We pray for that Thou forgive us for the times in which we have forgotten about Thee. But help us to remember Thee. Remember our Creator in the days of our youth. Remember while there is yet time, as we learn from the experiences of Solomon, as we learn from his regrets, from his mistakes, we pray that Thou help us to then fully understand what our life is really for, what Thou hast made us for, what Thou hast called us for, what Thou hast saved us for. And pray that Thou help us as we seek and search and question what is the purpose of this life. May use Thy Word, Thy Holy Spirit, to bring to light what the Gospel truly is all about, what it means to live a life for Christ, what it means to have our lives given over as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto Thee. We pray Thou guide us, even as we make our way home this evening. May You grant us journey mercies and bring us back here tomorrow evening to continue to study the book of Ecclesiastes together. We thank Thee in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.